Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 21 years of law enforcement analysis experience. All 21 years in Tukwila Police Department in Washington State. She is an active member of IACA and a founding member of the Northwest Regional Crime Analysis Network, also known as NORCAN. She's one of the few people that I know that has traveled to all 50 states. Please welcome Trina Cook. Trina, how are we doing?
I'm doing well, Jason. How are you?
Very good. How's Northwestern United States treating you?
It's a beautiful fall day. It's the Seattle that nobody thinks exists. Like blue skies, crisp, cool, but no rain at all.
All right. Well, so how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, back in the olden days, in the 90s, crime analysis didn't exist a lot of places yet. And certainly the West Coast, I think, was a little slower than the East Coast for some of this stuff. But I learned about it after I had gotten hired at my first job at Renton Police Department, which is just next door to Tukwila. I was a record specialist there. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do in law enforcement, but I was interested in law enforcement. Being a police officer was right for me. And so I got a job that I could get, right? You still have to pay the bills. And I got the record specialist job. And just a few months after I started, my colleague that some of us know, Christina Scholl, said she was leaving Renton to go be a crime analyst. I was like, wait a second, what's that job? And I hadn't seen the posting or anything, right? I had gotten a job, so I wasn't looking anymore. And Chris explained to me what the job was all about. And I was like, oh, that is what I want to do. So I didn't know about it until Chris got hired up at Kirkland Police. So back in 1993.
And then as the police service specialist, what kind of tasks were you doing there at Renton?
That's the basic front office records job. So we did all the front facing police lobby stuff for folks walking in with needs. We monitored the radio, but didn't dispatch, and then did all of the records processing. We entered cases back in the olden days when the officers wrote them by hand. We would enter all the cases, do the processing of court orders, protection orders, and that kind of thing. So all the basic records work.
So that sounds like that would really prepare you when you did go on to be a crime analyst.
It was a huge help. And especially since I just moved one city over, we have a Valley dispatch center, so Valley Communications. So I have the same exact CAD, and in records, you work with CAD all the time, the dispatch computer. So having that basic knowledge of law enforcement, it would have been a hard sell, I think, to say I would be a good crime analyst when I first came out of college. But having worked an entry-level job, you know, I called it my foot-in-the-door job, and it lasted over 6 years, but I learned a lot. And you learn not just the record stuff, but what it's like to work in a police department. It would have been really clear if I didn't like it by then. Yeah, so I think it was a great place to start. And it's different now. There weren't college courses on crime analysis and certificates and mapping and all of that stuff. That didn't exist. So you really had to get experience at a police department to kind of get started, I think.
You've been with the same department for 21 years. But I guess take us back to the first couple of months starting at the police department in 2000.
Oh man, I thought it was the best. I remember distinctly going over to have dinner with my parents and I said, I can't believe I get paid to do this. You know, I was on top of the world. I thought it was the coolest job, and it turns out it still is. You know, I sat across from the records unit, which was cool. It was kind of like, okay, these are my people. I understand what's going on. And I shared a cubby with the training officer. So they had an analyst a little while before me on a grant. And so there wasn't super established crime analysis. So it's not like I was creating the unit, but I did have opportunity to take it the direction I thought would be best. So it was pretty cool. I did a lot of the basic stuff. I looked at the files from the analyst before me, like, okay, they do auto theft. I should do an auto theft bulletin, you know, that kind of thing. There wasn't really someone saying, here's what we want from you. It took a lot of initiative just on my own to get things going. But yeah, back then, geez, I barely remember, honestly, at this point. But anything I wanted it to be, I could make it happen. And then since I knew Chris, I call her Chris, but Christina Scholl, since I knew her already, the thing that all new analysts in Washington did, basically, in Western Washington, was go sit with Chris for a day. And Kirkland was very generous with her time to let her mentor all of us in the field. And, you know, we've, maybe not during COVID, but we've kept that up. We've had lunch regularly over time just to check up. And we've worked on a lot of committees and things together, and obviously NORCAN. So it's great. That was the really the beginning of the community, I think, to kind of fall into having a community of people who care about you and want you to succeed. And so I really benefited a lot from that starting out too, not knowing anything about it otherwise.
It's interesting because some folks don't like that much autonomy, right? They want to be boxed in. They want to have goals. They want to have something to reach for. Give me something of what the analyst should expect to be doing. And then there's other people that are totally comfortable making their own path. And sure, it certainly seems like you're in the latter of that, plowing through what you thought needed to be done. So what are some of the things that you've been able to accomplish in the last 21 years?
Oh, geez, how do you summarize that?
Yeah, I get it. Sorry.
Well, I mean, I don't want to jump the gun too much about what being at the same department over time, you know, what it means. But if you're a self-starter and if you don't have someone saying, I want you to do these things, then you get to pick, right? And so it's on you to keep it interesting. It's not my employer's job to make me happy. So if I've got that autonomy, then I better take advantage of it. And I'm trying to think of like specific things or if there were products or anything like that, but I'm not shy about inviting myself to things. When I was at Renton, I served with the SWAT team as their scribe. So you just listen to the radio traffic and write everything down because I think that kind of stuff is cool and interesting. And so when I got to Tukwila, I said, hey, I can scribe. You know, I've been a scribe before. So when you put yourself out there and offer your services, you get to go do cool stuff. Being a scribe, then eventually I said, you know, anybody could scribe, but I can help you out with an analyst function on this stuff. And so I'd pull up maps and show them the news coverage of whatever incident and tried to become helpful in different ways. Try to be more of what my primary function was. So inviting myself along to that has been cool. So I was providing stats on our city has the region's largest shopping mall. So there's a lot of retail related crime, which isn't honestly that exciting, but I was pulling data for car prowl emphasis. And there's this one hotel that was getting hit a lot. And so they were going to do surveillance from inside the hotel with cooperation of the hotel management. And I was like, oh, well, I want to go. So you know, this isn't anything revolutionary, but kind of got to stick yourself out there. And so I got to go sit in a hotel room all night with one of the detectives and see what they see, you know, see what they look for. Because there's a lot that we know as analysts and you can pick up from the officers on what they're doing and how they do it. But it's really nothing like being out in the car with them or out on surveillance with them. So I don't know if those are the kind of, you know, accomplishments that you're looking for, but that's the kind of fun stuff that I've been able to take part in.
Next month, I'll be 10 years at Vanderbilt. So this is my longest tenured position that I've had. So you've been there twice as long as I have in my current role. So I'm thinking, geez, you know, you were pretty much starting from scratch in a way with the position. Maybe a better question is what were some of the obstacles that you faced maybe in the first 5 years or so, and how did you overcome those?
Well, there are some struggles that are never ending, right? Like total buy-in from officers or things like that. And I think you just have to keep trying different things. They didn't know me coming over, even though I was at the agency next door. I had actually done a ride along with someone at Tukwila before, because that's, again, the kind of person I am. Like, oh, I'm going to go ride with the city next to us. So I did know a couple people, but they didn't have any reason to think that I was useful, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got to keep trying things. And, you know, communication's only effective if it's received the way you intended. So I can put out whatever I want, but if the people I'm sending it to aren't acting on it or they won't use it, then that's my failure. That's my challenge to fix. I think that that's kind of ongoing. when you get new officers, if they don't have someone who's worked with you before, then why do they care what you do? I'm pretty lucky right now that I sit in our major crimes unit with a pretty good group of guys who knows what I have to offer. And so I don't have to really push for that. But you get new bosses all the time. And that was certainly true then. So you've got to kind of prove yourself again that you've got value to them and that you're a helper. So those types of things, I think, are really ongoing more so than just like, oh, I had this problem and then I solved it and it was never a problem again.
So then, and maybe you've answered this already, is that how did you prevent yourself from feeling like you were in a rut?
Not always successfully, but I think things ebb and flow. And maybe some people, they start to feel that lack of interest and that's when they apply for a new job. And I just didn't ever do that. I live in the city where I work. It's hard to, I don't even remember back then. I think I didn't at the time, but I lived in a neighboring city. I grew up right by here. Like this is my home turf. This is my home area. And when I bought a condo in 2008, I picked one that would let me walk to work. Like I'm super local about that.
Nice.
So staying had a lot of benefits outside of whether I was happy at my job or not. And again, it's not their job to make me happy, right? So what do I do? Well, when things start to kind of maybe drift or you feel like you're in a little bit of a lull, other opportunities come up and then that's when you take them, right? Like we're all too busy to add more stuff, except not always. So some things that have come up at a good time, and I don't remember if I'm getting these in order or not, but the department was looking at a new records management system. I'd been around a long time. I had records experience and I felt capable of managing a project. So I'd said I could do it. And they said, okay. So for, I don't know, a year and a half or something, I researched different RMS, I guess I can't call it an RMS system, right? Different records management systems. And, you know, went to the IACP conference and talked to a lot of vendors and did all the, you know, work group things at work, getting representatives from everywhere and getting everybody's input. I was the lead of it through contract signing. And by then they had hired a new records manager, and then that person took over for implementation. But that was a huge project. And had I been slammed at work, I wouldn't have taken it on. So that was an opportunity that, like, maybe things were in a bit of a lull, but I certainly made myself busy by taking that project on. And the same thing happened with the timing of being the certification chair. I was already on the certification committee, but the chair opportunity came up and I was, again, it was, you know, years later or something, or maybe it was years before, I felt like I could do it and that maybe I needed something to kind of spruce things up a little bit. So you just take other opportunities that maybe aren't standard crime analyst functions at the department, but something that might offer me a new experience.
So this brings us to your badge story, and the analyst badge story is the career defining case or project that an analyst works on. For you, you said you had a couple of them, but you wanted to talk about a story in particular dealing with a family situation, dealing with an elderly person.
Yeah. So this is, I think this story is interesting because it's not a typical crime with the victim where you want to catch the bad guy and the success is getting the arrest and a conviction, right? A lot of the work we do doesn't end in that. The majority of what we do doesn't end in that, unless maybe you're like in a violent crimes unit or something. But this came about, I review the cases, keep an eye on the cases from the day before to see if there's anything I should let the major crimes unit know as a heads up that something's coming. And we're a relatively small department, so like 30 cases a day maybe. So that's easy to manage. So I was reviewing the cases and I saw a call from a family member that thought their elderly relative had died because no one had spoken with her. And they suspected that her son had something to do with it. So, you know, that's interesting, right? I recognized the family because of our hotspots meeting in Tukwila, which is a meeting, monthly meeting of different departments throughout the city where we work on quality of life issues that overlap. Right? Because it's uncommon that only the police department has had an issue. So I was familiar with the family and thought that this was a pretty interesting case, but knew that on its surface wasn't a high enough priority that the detectives would get on it right away. So I asked the major crime sergeant, hey, can I do like a pre-workup on this case? Can I put together everything we know about them and then hand it over to the detective. So by the time they have time to work on it, they aren't starting at zero. And this isn't something we've done before or had a process for or anything like that. I'm the single analyst at the department. So, you know, my workload varies also that I can't do that all the time, but I could on this case. So I started working it up. And of course, because I'm chatty, I'm telling the guys about it too. And by the guys, I mean the detectives. And they're like, oh, that's interesting. Cause it has that little bit of intrigue. Like, is this woman dead? Is she not dead? So I was able to use my contacts with people I'd worked with before or had their names. I checked with the county medical examiner's office or the county records to verify if anyone had record of this person being deceased, and they didn't. So it just kept getting more interesting. And I got a hold of someone at Social Security and said, is this person still receiving benefits? And they said, yes. I'm like, oh, okay. All right. This is going to be good. Without belaboring the point altogether, like I said, I wasn't shy. I'm not shy about inviting myself to things. And I felt like I'd been in this from the beginning. So I had every reason to be there. But I was able to go along with the detective and the Social Security guy who we had met with previously, and to interview the son in this case, who is several counties away. And I didn't get out of the car at that point. I'm not shy, but I do have a good sense of fear. So I just stayed in the vehicle and let the commissioned people handle this interview. But the son was very cooperative, strangely. And we had collected enough information doing our work beforehand that the detective was able to say, ask us specifically where his mom might be, right? Because he was very smooth about it and said, like, I'm sorry about your mom, where we don't know that she's dead, but we're pretty sure she's dead. And he just like had that body language of like, oh yeah, you know, he loved his mom. It was a weird story, but he did love her. And so his body language was absolutely clear that she was deceased. We ended up going, he took us to family property where he had very carefully and lovingly, but buried her on family property. He says he thought that was lawful. It's not, but he was relatively believable. He's not maybe a great guy, but he was really relatively believable about why he did what he did. He thought he was allowed to have her money, but it was a family trust. And so, you know, to him, he thought he got her money. Now that's a different, you know, the Social Security people got to handle that side of it. But what we were able to do is recover her body and get it to the medical examiner's office or the coroner's office, whoever does it. We were a few counties away. They examined the remains, determined that she did not die of homicidal means or whatever they call it. It was a natural death. She was elderly, and it was a weird story, but the conclusion wasn't any sort of arrest or conviction. It was the family knowing that she had passed on her own and that there wasn't any more anybody taking advantage of her benefits. So it was fulfilling in a different way, but I felt like I got to help out at the beginning and kind of help make the case for why this case was worth looking at. And somebody like me who can spend the time doing the research on the computer versus the detectives, it would have been like, well, what do I do with this one now? You know? So yeah, that was a pretty cool one.
How long had she been buried in the backyard, I guess?
It was out on like an unpopulated lot, like a, okay, you know, empty land. I don't remember, a year or something. It wasn't, okay, you know, 20 years or anything.
Okay. But it wasn't like a week or two either.
So no, no.
It's been a while then too. So was there in family fighting going on?
He wasn't in touch with them. You know, he was of no help to them when they were trying to reach out. And so there is, I don't mean to act like, oh yeah, no, he sounded really believable. I'm sure he was telling the truth. There's a big question mark onto how much he believed, but especially for the Social Security stuff, he would have had to show true intent and knowledge in Washington state to get some sort of charges filed on this guy. And it's like, this isn't going to happen, you know, and what's our end goal here? They stopped paying. So the funds stopped going out, but yeah, there wasn't enough to take it further. And I think the detective and I both felt like the case had been resolved to a reasonable conclusion for the family.
Then do you know if he had to pay back the Social Security money back to the government?
I don't know. I haven't talked to that particular agent since then, but we were like, yeah, that's up to them. Yeah. And I don't know if he had any reasonable income enough to have even made it a thing, had they even gone after him for it.
Yeah, that does seem odd. I mean,
oh yeah,
you really thought that you should just be able to. Well, I mean, when did he think the Social Security benefits were going to end?
I know.
That's just interesting. Odd story, but very good. But again, to your point, you were a go-getter and were aggressive and were really helpful to the police department. And I think that's pretty much what your role has been for the last 21 years.
I'd like to think so. I hope that's my legacy, is they'll think, oh yeah, she was good to have around.
That's true. So what's next? I mean, not that you're trying to, like you're saying, like, oh, I'm moving on today, but I mean, what do you see in the near future for you at the police?
Well, one thing I've been working on, definitely on my own, not from them asking, is learning more about forensic genetic genealogy. I've seen presentations from, like, you know, Samantha Gwynn about the sexual assault kit initiative and what analysts can do to help with these types of things where we've got these old results, you know, old case results coming back with possible hits. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting how they learned that these serial sex offenders aren't just sex offenders. They're committing all sorts of other types of crimes where we may have their DNA hit on a sex offense, but it may also hit on a burglary or something where DNA was collected. So I think that that's a really fascinating kind of newer field about how analysts are getting involved with things like that. My department, I think I said, is relatively small, 79 commissioned, but we're in a major metropolitan area, the Seattle area. There's something there. I know there's something in our cases that we could work. And if somebody has the interest to be able to do the kind of work, you know, that'd be really satisfying. So one project I'm just barely starting on, like I saw the email today about, please give Trina a key card access to this room where the old files are stored. And I'm going to go through all of our unsolved homicides and be sure that there's nothing in there. And I got to help, our state patrol was working one of our cold case homicides. And I was just the coordinator, but to get them to review our evidence to see, is there anything we can test? And they sent a bunch of stuff off and they said the lab said it'll be, you know, a year or more until they're able to get to it. But I'd sure like to be part of it if that stuff starts coming back on hits, to start seeing what we can find out about these folks. So I'm just, you know, kind of barely dipping my toe into this, but I've connected with the other analysts who started the group for, I guess they're calling it investigative genetic genealogy, and just trying to learn what I can until maybe there's opportunity to do something with it. So that's exciting. I just got on our department's peer support team, and that's new for me. So that's not task work related, but part of being at work to keep things fulfilling and interesting. So there's plenty of new stuff happening, even 21 years in, to keep you interested in going to work.
So with the genealogy stuff, are you also looking to get into maybe where you can with some of the websites that collect genealogy information?
You mean like personally for doing my own stuff, or the, like, trying to find unknown relatives of an unknown subject?
Yeah, like for the police department. So getting the DNA that's been collected and getting a comparison, seeing if you can find relatives of the suspect.
Yes. Yep. That's the hope, is that we have a case where it's worthwhile to try to get that profile to try to then build it out and see if you can't identify someone. We just had a case just, you know, last year or something, where some bones had been recovered and then another agency had taken them for a different reason. But they got all of that work done, and they being, you know, who they contracted with, came back and said, we think it's this guy. And now it's our job to investigate that case. And I get to be part of that too. I think I said something like, I'd really like to be part of this. You know, I like to be really subtle about what my hopes are and hope they pick up on it. And the detective said, absolutely, I want you in on this. So yeah. So, you know, we're still plugging away at that. It's not all of these types of cases are the ones you can spend all your time on. Unfortunately, they're old enough that they can't take top priority over, you know, current shootings or homicides. So you fit it in where you can, but that's been rewarding too, to try to, it's like, nobody knows, none of us know how to do this, not the genetic genealogy part, but the what do we do now part, you know, we're all figuring it out together. So that's been pretty cool to try to help coordinate that information.
All right. Well, I do want to talk about peer support, but let's take a break and come back. We'll get into peer support. And of course, we'll talk about the IACA, NORCAN, and we'll even get into you being the state traveler. You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
So this is Sam, and I want to let you know that it's okay to talk to strangers. Obviously not if you are four or if you're walking alone at night or in the woods. But in general, if you're just out in your day-to-day life or you're traveling or whatever, talk to somebody, talk to strangers. It makes you a more interesting person because it gives you more perspective on life. Everyone is walking around with an interesting story. So many people will defy your expectations when you see someone and you make certain assumptions about them, whether they're conscious or unconscious. I love the moment when you realize you were wrong. It's a great feeling, and I think it makes your life richer in general. You know, if you're too shy, then maybe just read Humans of New York. That might help you to understand other people's experiences. But I'm just here to say, don't not talk to strangers.
Hi, this is Jeffrey Vandersip, and I'm going to tell you about a couple of my pet peeves. Pet peeve number one is the size of parking lots at grocery stores. They create these parking lots for Yugos, and yet everybody is now driving a Ford F-150, and you can't fit in anything, or if you do, you're banging the doors of your neighbors. Pet peeve number two is the little button in cars that open the fuel filler door seems to be in the most oddest of places. And whenever I go somewhere else and I rent a car and I have to go to the gas station for the first time, I spend a half hour trying to figure out how to open the fuel filler door. Pet peeve number three is just packaging generally with things that you get in the mail. It's like Russian nesting dolls. You've got a box, and inside that box is another box. Inside that is another box. Inside that is a bubble wrap. And then you get to like a little piece of whatever, which is the thing actually sent. And finally, and again, betraying my age here, the screen filters that people use in their social media, everybody kind of looks like somebody out of Avatar. What's up with that?
Welcome back. You mentioned it prior to the break about getting into peer support. I guess let's just talk about why you got into this and what your role is.
Sure. Well, we're really just starting up. I was only accepted onto the team just a few months ago. So I'm no expert at all, but I think this concept of mental health in law enforcement, you see it more and more. I know you had Kyle Stoker on and he talked about his role on the team and explained what they do pretty well. But maybe over the last couple of years, I started learning a little bit more about the effects that this industry has on primarily its officers, but I recognized some of those things in myself. And it's no surprise, right? Since 1993, that's a long time. It's my whole adult life, my whole career. But to learn about how those things really related to me specifically, because it's really easy over time to say, well, I'm not the officer. It's not like I went and saw it. It's not like I had to pull my gun and worry about getting shot. I wasn't the call receiver or the dispatcher who's hearing the screams and all the different things people are going through on the worst day of their lives. I'm not experiencing that. You know, I'm just looking at the paperwork or hearing some of the calls on the radio, but that stuff can really have an effect. And so I learned what secondary trauma was and thought, oh, okay. Yes, I'm exposed to all of those things. I'm worried for my officers when I hear the radio call and you're just, you know, it's silence and you're just waiting for that code four to come over the air and you kind of breathe out like, oh, okay, all right, here we go. Everybody's fine. But all of the excitement of a hot call coming out, everyone running out of the office, except for you, you see them tear out of the parking lot, lights and sirens, the adrenaline's going, that's happening to us too. So and then hypervigilance is another one where you think, oh yeah, that's that cop. They always sit with their back to the wall. They never sit in front of the room, you know? And you think, well, that's not me. You know, I sit with my back to the door because the officer wants to sit across from me with their back away from the door. So that doesn't match my experience, except for when you're out for a walk, my experience, I see a weird guy and I think, okay, if I had to call 911, what street am I on? How tall is he? What is he wearing? What color is his hair? What would I say to the call receiver? Like, apparently that's not completely normal behavior and isn't how regular folks experience the world and just going for a walk in their neighborhood. So if you are listening to this and you recognize, oh, well, I do that too. Isn't that normal? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you have a problem. It just means that over time you may want to learn about secondary trauma and how that can affect your home life. I think it's really interesting, and I don't necessarily feel like I'm in crisis over this, but I can see how it could affect your home life, having experienced all these different things. And if you don't have someone at home that you can talk to about it, or anyone in the department who maybe would understand where you're coming from, that could be challenging over a career's worth of incidents that get you to these points where you're really experiencing that trauma. So that's kind of how it came up for me. A friend she's now retired, but was on peer support. You should join the team. I'm like, oh, I don't know. That's just for officers. But it's not. The IACP recommends having all types of folks on your peer support team. And if coming from them isn't enough to convince your department to open it up to sworn and non-sworn or, civilian and commissioned or however you define it, I don't know what would. That's the International Association of Chiefs of Police making these recommendations. And my department, it was open to anybody. So I went ahead and put in. And to me, I'm definitely interested in ensuring that non-sworn or professional staff, however you define it, know different things to kind of keep an eye out for. It's not like over 21 years of working in law enforcement that I've never talked to an officer about how things are going. Mm-hmm. I think I can be useful to everyone. I used to sit in the chief's office, and a lot of patrol officers don't just wander by for fun. So the chief would come in and maybe talk about something that was going on because they thought I was trustworthy. I wouldn't spread gossip about what the chief said that day. And so I felt like I was serving that role in a really informal way. And I decided to go ahead and get the training and try to learn what more I could do to be helpful. So it's a different thing that's not crime analysis work, but I think it's really important. And if I can make a difference or help a new person coming onto the department feel like they fit in better or that somebody cares or, something, that would be really rewarding.
That's interesting. When you were telling your story about walking in the park there, I thought, I don't necessarily do that, but I know if my kids are 30 seconds longer than what they should be out of my sight, start to wander, I'm a recovering helicopter parent. And, and then I get to on myself. I was like, oh, I have no idea what they're wearing.
Right. Like, yeah.
I don't have any idea what they're wearing or anything like that. I'm going to be in trouble, of course. Then they all show up.
Right.
So to the peer support group, then what training is involved?
We're getting there, right? Like I said, it was just a couple months ago. So we are going to have a critical incident stress debriefing sort of training with one of the chaplains in the Valley. He puts that on. And then they're sending me to a first responder conference, I think. And it's from folks that are really into all of this mental health stuff, peer support stuff, mental health heavily for law enforcement and firefighters. But they're also groups that make me feel comfortable and welcome that talk about professional staff and dispatch. Like they really recognize it's all of us in this whole field of, public safety arena, maybe. And so I'm going to a conference on that will include presentations from a variety of different groups, not just law enforcement.
Seems like it could be a tough scenario for someone because it seems like it's really on the periphery for, he's talking about secondary trauma. I think if you're really having
PTSD.
Yes, thank you. If you're having that, I mean, there can be really some profound symptoms that you're going through. But if it's something that's more subtle and you're just not sure whether you're there or not, you maybe not be sure what you should do about it, if anything.
Right. Yeah. How do you know? And I think teaching people or, letting them know what types of things are or could be examples of this would help them. Like for myself, that's kind of how it happened, right? Like, now that I know, I can relate to that. Our department started a wellness day kind of program where you can go speak with a therapist who was vetted by the department and she works with law enforcement. So she's, she's familiar, right? It takes somebody who really understands to be helpful. And you can go take a day off, a work day, and speak with her, but you don't even have to talk to her. She'll introduce herself and talk with you about what you can do and You have to fill out the form that you were there. I don't know if anybody's taken her up on just leaving. You know, I talked to her. I talked to some of the guys who had talked to her, and they said, yeah, she's good. And this is available to our non-sworn staff too. And so, of course, I took advantage of it because that's kind of what I do. So it was really helpful. And to talk to some of my buddies that see a therapist and trying to reduce that stigma of therapy in law enforcement, especially, but in kind of general, the general public as well. And so I'm just trying to talk about it more, make sure the front office knows that this is available to them, for example, because they, you know, it's easy to feel left behind sometimes on stuff like that, initiatives like that, that seem to be focused on the officers. But yeah, I think just trying to get the word out there of, well, here's what I experienced and here are some other true things. And if you experience them or feel like it may be affecting your life outside of work, you can talk to somebody. There are resources and there are law enforcement specific resources to kind of help smooth some of the rough edges, I think, of making that leap emotionally of going to therapy.
It seems like it could be a wide variety of things, but I think you might have hit the nail on the head there, where if you feel that it's impacting your life, mm-hmm. that's when you should consider talking to somebody about it, even, you know, no matter in what degree.
Right. You don't have to be broken to work on fixing it. Or for me, my take has been, I don't want it to get any worse. I have some identified things that I'm like, yeah, that's not perfect, but I'm managing fine. You know, I talked to my wife about it. You know, do you feel like this is affecting our relationship, or do you feel like this is a bigger deal than I can see it as? And, you know, we talk about those things, and I don't want to wait until a crisis happens. And we have that opportunity with some folks, you know, so let's, you know, you don't, I'm trying to think of like some sort of house repair analogy, but you really don't have to wait until you spring a leak to redo your plumber's tape or something like that. That's a terrible analogy, but I think that's where some of the knowledge and education about mental health and law enforcement is going, is like, Sally Rawlings did the class at IACA, and I'm really hoping that IACA will continue to have folks who want to teach stuff like this. Cause if you don't know, how would you know until you know that this may apply to us too? I think it's really cool that Sally taught that. And there's been some other offerings, and folks like Kyle, like I said, are serving on their peer support team. The more of us who are doing it and talking about it, the more maybe younger folks or people just coming into the profession might say, oh, okay. So it's okay that I was really upset by that. Like, yeah, it's weird stuff we deal with. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Cause I know when I go for checkup, whether it's the, you know, the eye doctor, the normal doctor, dentist. I mean, I will point out stuff. And it's like, not that I'm really worried about it, but that's something that can lead to something more serious.
And right,
that's
exactly.
That's usually how my mind's working. I was like, and I usually get that look, and I almost have to tell them, it's like, not that I'm not really worried about it, and I'm not really a hypochondriac. I just, you know, this is what's happening. And this, I just want to know, can it get worse, or what are some signs I should look for moving forward that would lead to me knowing that it got worse.
Exactly.
So there's definitely opportunity there, and there's help there. I think that's what's nice, what you talked about in terms of getting the word out, is there's help available, and that hopefully, again, as you mentioned, some of the stigma or whatever it is, it doesn't mean you're weak to go seek help.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Well, let's move on then. I do want to talk a little bit about the IACA. You just mentioned them, and you have had several roles with the IACA. I think when we started to know each other, I knew you from the certification committee when you were chair of that. But you've been on the conference committee, the technology committee, and now you're on the regional committee. You know, one of the things I hear about a lot is from folks is how you get involved. But I think you and I are kind of alike in that we just say, we start asking questions of people, and we just start saying, well, I'd be willing to do that if you need some help doing it. And you kind of get involved. And I don't know if that's how you ended up getting so many gigs with the IACA or not.
I think you're the sucker who doesn't say no at some point. Yeah, I met Chris Bruce pretty early on. And of course, he, you know, encourages people to join and be on a committee. And I said no forever. And I remember, I don't know what I joined first, but he said, oh, sure, now. You know, I've been telling you for 10 years or something to help out. But yeah, he was giving me some grief for it, for finally joining a committee. But I don't even remember. I don't remember what was first. But when you know a bunch of people who are serving on boards, then you know more what's out there. Maybe you're exposed to it more easily than other folks. But yeah, you just don't say no. At some point, you're all of a sudden on a committee.
With certification, that's always a fascinating topic for me with this profession, just because there's so much to it. And there's not one central certification for this profession. As you're running this for the IACA, you're competing against colleges that have certification, states that have certification, even other associations having certifications. So what is your feeling about certification with this profession?
Hard. It is hard and complicated and complex and changing, just to make it easy. I do remember how I got on the certification committee, because I got certified in 2012. And then Michelle Kennedy, the chair at the time, said, hey, we're looking for people and you're certified, so you can join. I'm like, okay. So Michelle talked me into it. And I have been following her too, just on a side little spur. Michelle was certification chair, and then I followed her and I was certification chair. And she's also one of the leaders in the investigative genetic genealogy arena. She's doing a lot of cold case. I think that's her primary function right now, is doing this type of work. And so I'm like, well, Michelle's doing it, it's got to be cool. So, you know, following her along. But yeah, certification, it is very difficult. And I think that the IACA is an appropriate group to serve this role as this one who certifies their analysts. And I think they've done some pretty incredible work to get an entry-level analyst certification to show for these folks who have been educated with formal education. And so to kind of prove that they're ready to be an analyst, that's pretty incredible that they got going, and then have this experienced analyst exam, which is kind of where they started, was you've been an analyst for a number of years, you've accomplished certain things to reach enough points to test. But I think it's been a continual challenge to meet the needs of employers or the analysts themselves. What's the goal? What are we trying to do? And like I said, I think the IACA is the right group to do it, being the main professional association internationally, along with some others, like you said, maybe ILEA, or, you know, focusing on more intel stuff. But yeah, it is complicated and difficult to try to establish this exam that will meet most people's experience. There's stuff people often say, I've never done that in my job. Does this mean I'm a bad analyst? Like, no, that's not what your agency needs from you. But yeah, it's very difficult.
With the certification, it is difficult to administer, because if you're just going to do a test, then there's certainly going to be people that are not good test takers. And while they may be good analysts, they are going to struggle with the exam.
Yep.
And you might have vice versa too. You might have somebody that's really not very experienced or not as good, maybe I'll use that word terms. And and they can pass the exam and they're certified, right?
Right.
It comes down to this multiple choice test that is given for the IACA. Do you think the test is multiple choice test is enough, or were you wanting to maybe do something else during your term there?
Oh, I certainly didn't come up with anything revolutionary. I felt like I was struggling to keep my head above water at all, creating the third edition of the exam. But there were folks that thought there should be some sort of essay format. And as the chair at that point, I thought, how would we score that? You know, this seems nearly impossible. It's overwhelming as it is to even collect the proofs that you've met the points available. You know, it's really an immense amount of manual work for the committee. And so my main take on it wasn't so much, let's think of something new. It was, how can we keep going with what we've got? So I was not the best person to be the chair forever. So I did step down relatively soon. I didn't make it nearly as far as Michelle did. But it may be true that there may need to be a new format to be best, but we were doing what we could to be better. So yeah. I think if there are new and interesting ideas, apparently there's some sort of scoring metric thing that colleges and universities use maybe to score essays,
yeah,
where the professor doesn't have to read them all. So there may be things like that, but I was not the person to lead them to that.
Yeah, and I had a similar conversation once with Jason Panich, who used to be in the chair of IECA's colleges and university, and I asked them something similar to that. I was like, how do you go about grading an essay, right? Isn't that pretty subjective? And he said, no, there's actually standards with colleges and universities, as you just mentioned, of how to go about grading an essay.
Right.
Taking out some of the subjectivity of it. But I always thought the reason you have multiple choice tests is that they're easy to grade, right? There's one answer, and you can do the bubble test. You can scan it through the computer, and you can have a grade back in 10 seconds, right? After turning it in, that's the reason why we have those multiple choice tests, is because they're easy to grade and easy to get the results. But it does seem to be something there to where if you're presenting or you're doing essay like you mentioned or something to show that you have the skills necessary to be a certified analyst. Seems like that would be the way to go. But also I acknowledge that that's a pretty tall order to be consistent and to come up with similar results over and over and over again.
Right. I mean, the other thing is, what does anybody get from it? You know, certification is another one of those things that I did to continue to develop myself, make sure that I was holding myself to a higher standard. And at the time, back in 2012, there was only one other certified analyst in Washington, and it was a commissioned guy. It was Tony Berger, who you've had on the show.
Okay.
And I was like, I can't let the commissioned people be the only certified analyst in Washington. So, you know, I pushed myself for that, and I, you know, gave Tony grief for it too, of course, because he's good for it. But it's such a variable field. While there are basics that most of us know or do probably, so many analysts do so many different things that I think it's really challenging. And honestly, maybe the entry level analyst is, you know, better, because what you could see how that could get you a job. Mm-hmm. But with the few of us who are certified, what does it get me? It certainly doesn't get me anything at work. I've tried to get it into our contract for maybe a little more pay or something. And they keep rejecting that. So I'm not sure that, other than the personal choice for professional development, I don't know what what we can say it would get someone.
Yeah. I mean, I basically just got a Vataboy at the police department when I got my certification.
Yeah.
And it's mostly just for me, right? And
right.
Just similar to what you just said. It should do something for you, though. I would think mm-hmm. that it would be kind of a feather in your cap for when you do go to your evaluation and maybe they're considering you for a raise. I would think that that's where it should come into play. Like, oh, you are now certified. That's different. You're now different from what you were last year at this time. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. My department recognized me in front of city council. It's not like they ignored it. It was nice, but until it comes down to money in your pocket. I mean, I think for those of us who are represented, I've been in a union my whole career. I think it would be reasonable to have that as a pay increase. Officers at our department get extra pay for education and experience beyond what's required for their job. And it made sense to me that this job would have that too for certification, but so far no go.
Hopefully they come around.
So. I don't know if I can fight that anymore. You just give up at a certain point, you know.
Well, okay. You're going to be there for another 21 years, so you got some time.
Oh my goodness. And you'd think, one would hope that even if it weren't a requirement for the job or if you didn't get extra pay, one would hope that if I were applying for a job and other things were equal with another candidate, I would hope that being certified would at least be a plus, you know?
I would think so too. All right. Well, let's talk about NORCAN now, because you are one of the founding members, and that was developed right in 2000. So you were starting as a crime analyst. You were getting together this group of people that would eventually become the NORCAN Association.
Yes, Christina Scholl, who I've mentioned before at Kirkland Police, and Kim Hathaway at Kennewick Police in Eastern Washington, and I just thought, well, let's all get together. Let's talk. Because back in the olden days, you know, we would send bulletins in the U.S. Postal Service, right? They'd be stuffing envelopes and putting stamps on to send bulletins out. The ability, you couldn't email. We didn't have email then. So, and I hope the younger folks are just cringing, like, seriously, how old are these people? But, and we're still working in the field. So, so getting together in person was even more important. I still think it's crucial today, but yeah, so we started getting together.
to meet up and meet each other and see, you know, put faces to the mailing labels.
I find it fascinating that all three of you are got together and all three of you have basically been with the same department this whole time.
Yeah, we all have. And Kim had experience before Kennewick as well. So just like Chris at Renton PD, like I was.
So then I always think of the regional associations as just a mini association, because you get to the point where, yeah, in the beginning you're doing meetings and you're networking and you're trying to get to know your neighboring peers, but it gets a little bit more serious. And then you get into bylaws and you get into elections and you get into training, and some even get big enough to where they're holding their own conference. Where was the progression for you? Because you guys started out just meeting, and then eventually you're a full-fledged mini association.
Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the things that's important for NORCAN, important enough to mention it, is that we didn't just meet. We always went to lunch after. I'm a big fan of the lunch. And, you know, you get into conversations that aren't just the agenda or going around the room and sharing about whatever's going on. And so the lunches were for fun and for actual eating. But I think those really kind of set the foundation to all of us really getting to know each other. I mean, I consider these folks similar to IACA friends. Like they're my friends. They are in my circle. I think those meetings led to that. But it was some folks that said we should have bylaws and a board or something. And I was like, oh man, can we just not meet and go to lunch? And so it took folks pushing me, because I was kind of, I guess, the main person or something, to agree to do that. And so we met, we used other analyst association bylaws to create our bylaws, decide what we wanted to be. We eventually got, I never remember if it's 501c3 or 3c, but either way, you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. We eventually got that set up, and that meant we had to have a treasurer, and like, oh man, I don't want to charge dues and keep track of all that stuff. And so we have dues now because it's dual membership with IACA, but that was other people. And then NORCAN does have conference now and a symposium. But here's the key is I was president for a long time, but it's, you have to know when to step down. And that doesn't mean that I was doing a bad job, but I knew I wasn't going to take us to the next step of having things like conferences. And I don't even know if I was in charge when we hosted trainings, maybe, but I stepped down. I didn't want to do that stuff. And I knew that there were probably other people who would move the association forward. And that's what Joe Ryan has done as president, with, you know, an eager board to work on. And he made the mistake of telling me one time, I think I might like to be more involved with NORCAN. And so when I was going to step down and not run again for president, I called him up. I said, hey, Joe, remember that time you said you might be interested in doing a little more? How about being president? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's how you get stuck doing stuff, is someone maybe cajoles you into taking a step slightly larger than you thought you might be ready to do. But Joe took it forward and did the conference and stuff. So as much as it's nice to kind of stay comfortable in your leadership position, it's, you have to know when it might be time to step aside and let someone else with different energy step in and do more.
What states are involved with NORCAN? I should have looked that up before.
Yeah, I should have looked it up too. It's mostly the Northwest, like Washington, Oregon, Idaho, but we kind of take anybody. We had somebody in Wyoming a while back. It's whatever you would call the Northwest region.
Yeah. Oh, very good. Well, let's get into some advice you have for our listeners. We've mentioned it a couple of times. You've been an analyst since 2000. And one of the questions I like to ask is, started in 2000, what was something that you thought, oh, by 2021, we'll have this figured out? And yet we are still dealing with it today.
Oh, man. Clean data. Does anyone not complain about clean data? The first thing, honestly, that came to mind was convincing people to not leave valuables in their cars. It seems like I've seen that sign in parking lots for my whole life. And yet we still take so many theft from vehicle reports. And I hate it because the victims, you know, while technically you might say maybe what they did was wrong, they aren't doing anything wrong. You shouldn't have to take everything with you, but it is so traumatic. Sometimes people get some really valuable stuff stolen and you think, why did you leave it in your car? So I hate that criminals get to take advantage of kind-hearted people who wouldn't think it would happen to them. But I don't know how we haven't solved that problem yet either.
So almost every park in America is going to have that sign.
Absolutely.
And you're right. So how about return on investment? What's something that an ALS can study today because 5 years from now it's going to be important?
Geez, you know, I don't have a great answer for this because I feel like you can be taught a lot of things, but you can't be taught how to be curious. I've talked to a lot of people who say, oh, your job sounds really cool, but I'm not good at math. Well, okay. I might argue about how much your actual math skills are the most important thing. Mm-hmm. I'm like, look, you don't have to be a math superstar, a mathlete. Is that what they're called? Yeah. But if you're curious and inquisitive and won't just stop at the simple answer, I feel like that is maybe more important to this job. So that I don't have a great answer for what's still going to be worthwhile. Because if you have a curiosity, an innate curiosity or true interest in this field, that will carry you through. Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a variety of ways. I mean, and you've talked about them during this interview, is there's more than one way to be a good analyst.
Right.
And I remember with Mary Berticelli on the show, she said right away when she was interviewing, she's like, I don't know anything about mapping. I always sent it to the mapping guys. I didn't do that. I did other analysis work. And so it's not just one thing. Just because you may have questionable math skills, well, there's ways around that. And as long as you do your due diligence to make sure that the report and your work and your product is correct, you can get around that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do find it interesting that talking with my stepbrother about this the other day, in that, you know, we both said that we wish we would have listened more when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
About either stuff around how to fix stuff around the house or fix stuff in the garage or fix something. And I told him, I said, you know, the problem is like, we didn't need it. He's like, now that we're 40 something, we need all that stuff. But when you're young and, you know, if you don't need it, you may not necessarily think you need to learn it.
Right.
And I think that's what's harder with some of this question about return on investment, right? It's until you need it, it's kind of hard to envision why you would need to learn it.
Right. Well, you know, I did think of one thing, and I don't know if they teach it. I haven't been in high school for a long, long time, right? But back in my day, they would teach keyboarding or typing or whatever you want to call it, but actual typing, not hunt and peck, not, you know, typing with your thumbs like we do on our phones. But I see our officers struggle with it. And I thought, why do we not train these guys? Why do we not give them typing classes? You can do it all on the computer, right? Wouldn't it be more efficient for them to be an efficient typist? And for an analyst, my mom taught me back when I used to, you know, do work for her, she taught me how to use the 10 key keypad. Mm-hmm. And I know that for analysts, we're doing a lot of stuff with numbers. I use the 10 key all the time. So that's a skill that I think I might sound like the oldest person ever right now, but I do think that that's an efficient skill that anyone can learn it, and that I've used it my whole life.
Yeah. And it's probably a dying practice though, you know, with the speech to text technology, right? It's probably when you're done with your next 21 years, it probably won't even have keyboards.
We'll see, I guess, but I don't know. Is that really faster? Like for a fast typist, you can cover a lot of territory.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, that's definitely something that with my kids, we try to get them into some typing games so they can learn mm-hmm. how to type. So
mm-hmm.
Let's talk about personal interest now. And as I mentioned in your introduction, you have visited all 50 states.
I have.
Which is quite an accomplishment.
It feels like one. It's a good goal to set if that's kind of your thing. But the cool thing is that the IACA has gotten me to several of these states. So how this all kind of came about, in 2010, I was ready to take some big vacation and I decided I would drive around the country. And I took 45 days off work. We have pretty good vacation accrual and you can like roll it all over. So I was able to accrue a bunch of time. So that was what, six weeks or something. And I drove across kind of the top and then down and across the back of kind of through the middle. I didn't go all the way down. And I hit 37 states on that trip, many of which I had been to before. I don't remember how many new states I hit, but I only had, I think I had 7 left at that point in 2010. And I thought, okay, well, before I turn 50, I want to hit the rest of these states. So I don't remember all of the places that IACA was the only reason I was there, but it was certainly the only reason I was in Kentucky. And so I went to the Louisville conference a few years ago. And if I was all the way over there, I was going to hit West Virginia because those were kind of the two kind of in that area that I hadn't hit yet. So I took a road trip with a friend and we went into West Virginia, stayed a night, and then went back for the conference. So that was pretty cool. And then I had 5 left, including Louisiana. So I flew into Louisiana, and then my wife and I drove and hit Alabama, Mississippi. And I had been to, you know, Florida before we went to Florida. And then we hit Georgia. No, I'm going to get either way, South Carolina was the last one. That was my last
Georgia,
state.
It would have been Georgia, then South Carolina.
South Carolina was the last one. And we were fleeing, trying to keep ahead of a hurricane, whichever it was that year, Irma, maybe. So we really just got out and I had a picture, a map of the country, and we took a picture and then fled to safety with all the Floridians who were fleeing the hurricane. So yeah, that was pretty cool. And I liked, and then we went back, ended up back in New Orleans for the conference that year. So yeah, I ended in the South. Like I said, I can't remember which other states I only went to because of IACA. Missouri, I went to the Kansas City Conference. Okay. I went to Kansas that trip. So yeah, it was pretty cool. It was fun to meet my goal. Met it long before, I haven't quite turned 50 quite yet. But yeah, I met that. And it's neat to have seen some piece of every state in the country.
Wow. Yeah, no, that is very impressive. And it makes me think of what states that I haven't been to. But I do have a pretty big chunk that I haven't been to, especially actually in your neck of the woods there. I mean, other than Washington, again, you're talking about when it was in Bellevue there with the IACA, that's the only time I've been in that general area. You know, then there's Colorado, but everything in between Washington and Colorado there, that whole corner there, I haven't explored that at all. The Dakotas and Montana and all of that. So yeah, there's probably, just off the top of my head, there's probably 20 that I haven't been to.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I don't know if I'm going to get there before 50. I got about 5 years to do it. So. So anyway, well, good. Congratulations. That's quite a feat.
Thank you. It was neat. You know, you set these arbitrary goals as grown-ups, right? Like, well, what do I want to do now? I guess I'll make sure I've been to every state. I don't know why it's a thing, but it seemed cool, and it gave us some direction for where to go on trips, like for that last trip, for sure, to make sure to hit all the states without spending too much time in any of them.
Well, our last segment of the show is Words of the World, and this is where I give the guests the last word, and you can promote any idea that you wish. Trina, what are your words to the world?
This is a great one. Everybody make sure to pay attention so you understand. Touch your toes every day. Move your body. It's that simple. I didn't used to be able to touch my toes, and maybe everyone can, but I started trying, and just giving your body the littlest bit of stretching and movement every day will help continue your health and happiness throughout your life.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later, but I do appreciate you being on the show, Trina. Thank you so much. And you be safe.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.